This is the Radio Walensky Podcast. I'm Richard Walensky with new and archive interviews from the Probabilities and Book Waves, Art Waves programs on KPFA FM and Pacifica Syndication. Josh Costello is the artistic director of Aurora Theater in Berkeley and has been since 2019.
Yeah, 6 months before the pandemic. It was a great, auspicious beginning.
We're going to talk about what's happening with Aurora now, which is we're on a tightrope, I guess.
Yeah, it's not what I imagined for 4 years into my artistic directorship.
I've talked to a lot of artistic directors about the experiences since the pandemic, but I've not spoken with you. This is our first time in, it feels like 2 years, but it's actually five.
It's been a long time.
So let's go back before we come up and talk about the current season and the past season. Let's go back to 2019. You're hired. At that point, things are going pretty well for Aurora, I guess. You're getting good audiences.
Very much so.
And then suddenly in March, everything shuts down. When it shut down, were you on the verge of a show? Had one opened? Do you remember?
We had just had our first day of rehearsal for Joe Orton's Loot, which was directed by Tom Ross, who was my predecessor. And we had such a great time at that first rehearsal. You know, we always bring in our whole staff, our, you know, board members, donors, friends. And it was so funny to hear that play. It's a great play. And I'm hoping that we'll be able to bring it back sometime. There was all this buzz in the room, all this energy, and then a couple days later, we had to shut down the building and cancel the production. And we thought at that point, you know, oh, it'll be a few weeks, right? And we announced our 2020-2021 season as if, because, you know, it's not going to be more than 6 months. Then we had to cancel that season as well.
And during that period, which I guess lasted until, I believe, summer of 21, which is when the vaccines became widespread, we learned more about COVID. People were able to wear masks.
That's right.
In that year and a half, were you doing a lot of online stuff?
We were. We did some really interesting work during that time. The first big thing was our online gala, which we had been planning to do in person. We had to shift it online, and it ended up being a really fun online event with performances from artists and so forth. The first thing actually that we did was we started a weekly Zoom talk show called Aurora Connects, where we interviewed artists, starting with the artists who are going to be in that play, but also, you know, people like the mayor of Berkeley and, you know, people from other theaters and Lily Janik, the reviewer from The Chronicle. We have all these episodes of Dawn, who was our associate artistic director at the time, and myself interviewing these really interesting people. During that interregnum, we also did two audio dramas. And Aurora, you know, we're known for our intimacy. We have such an intimate theater with the audience wrapped around three sides. It's only four rows deep. And part of the appeal is that you're right in the room with the actors. And so we're able to do this really detailed, nuanced work. And the idea of doing things on video, which was not something we had a lot of expertise in, didn't seem right for what we do. And so instead, we hit on the idea of doing audio dramas where this voice in your ear is very intimate and there's something that's very similar about it. So we commissioned three local playwrights, Jonathan Spector, Lauren Gunderson, and Cleavon Smith, to write an original audio drama, which, you know, when we hired great actors and recorded it remotely and put it all together. And then we did The Bluest Eye as an audio drama as well, which was one of the shows that I believe was going to be in our season. It wasn't the same as having a season of plays, but at least we were still telling stories for our community, and it gave people a reason to stay connected with us. When we came back in 2021, our first production in that season, we did entirely on video because our space was not, you know, it's so intimate and so close that we needed a little more time to get ready to have people breathing the same air again. And so that show, we fully staged, built the set, hung the lights, did the whole thing, and then brought in a professional video crew to shoot it, and we streamed a recorded performance of the play. That play was Stoop Stories by Dale Orlander Smith, starring Janae Simon. And then the first show that was actually with an audience in our space was Father Daughter by Kate Carrigan.
And then you were suddenly sort of back.
Then we were back. We had to cancel the next show because of Omicron, if you remember that, and move it to the following fall. So it was a rocky start.
Well, Josh Costello, things are different now. I remember during the pandemic, I had a talk with David Thompson, who's a well-known film critic. about what would happen when things came back. And one of our observations was that because every film was streaming, movie theaters might not come back, but people would really go out to live shows. Sadly, that did not work out. Now, it's my understanding that when things came back, what didn't come back was season subscriptions.
That's correct. We're still at about half the number of season subscribers that we had in 2019.
What do you think caused that?
I think it's a lot of things. I mean, we had been expecting every year that, okay, this is the year that it's going to start changing again. And we've been budgeting for it that way, which is something I'm sure we'll get into in a moment. But I think it's a lot of different factors. I think a lot of people got out of the habit of coming to live theater and it's slow to get back in. I think some of the people who were our subscribers were of an older generation and felt less safe coming back and being around people. We do have masked performances twice a week, and we're going to continue that into the new season. And I think people got very used to having the instant gratification of being able to pick whatever show they wanted to watch, being able to pick whatever movie they wanted to watch, being able to look at their social media from the comfort of their home. And the thought of getting out of the house, you know, everybody talks about, oh, yeah, I need to get out of the house more. But, oh, gosh, but I haven't actually done it in, how long? And I think theaters have really suffered from that in the Bay Area and around the country.
Has it changed for the actors?
I think there's less work for the actors. We've had several theaters in the Bay Area have closed down. And a lot of people during the pandemic had to find other jobs, other ways to make a living. And some number of those people have not come back to theater.
One advantage, perhaps, and maybe this is completely wrong, is that Aurora, being somewhat down the list of where plays will go. I mean, you know, if someone wants to do it at Berkeley Rep, Aurora's not going to get it. But Lifespan of a Fact, I would have thought, would have gone to one of the larger theaters, and you managed to snag it.
Yeah, so the rights holders only allow one theater in a region to do a play, and we have to sort of wait for Berkeley Rep and ACT to pass on it. And then there's sort of a knife fight between us and SF Playhouse and Marin Theater Company. And that one, you know, another theater, a larger theater, was holding the rights to it and was thinking about doing it. And it ended up and I was in touch. We all talked to each other. And they ended up deciding not to do it. And because we had been talking with them and we had been talking with rights holders, we swooped in and were able to get the rights. And it turned out to be a fabulous production.
Yeah, I gave it a rave review here. So
thank you.
One other question before we move on to the financial issues, which are a little bit too much at the forefront of your mind. Black Lives Matter came along. When I spoke to you in 2019, you were already thinking of changing what Aurora was doing to take more into account, I guess, the Berkeley vibe, which would be more of the Black Lives Matter vibe. So you were a little ahead of the game, you think?
I like to think so. I think I had a lot to learn as well as, you know, somebody who grew up in Berkeley, grew up in a very diverse community, was taught to value diversity from a very young age, you know, and yet I am a straight, cis, white man, and I have my blind spots. And so I was very interested when I accepted the position in finding ways to balance that out and to make sure that we were really a company that was inclusive for everyone. And I think for a long time, Aurora has done a fantastic job of telling stories that really speak to its audience. And it had not done enough, in my opinion, and I, with no disrespect to Tom Ross or Barbara Oliver, who are fantastic artists and fantastic leaders, I thought there was more that we could do. And so we, you know, we instituted various measures right away. We had already started, under Tom, you know, trainings. You know, we talked about microaggressions. We did a town hall about microaggressions that happen in public spaces because we were listening to people and we were hearing that in public spaces like Aurora and other theaters and everywhere else. But at Aurora, it was particularly young people of color were feeling unwelcome for a whole host of different reasons. And we started really digging into it and trying to figure out what we could do to be a place that doesn't just say that everyone is welcome, but that actually makes everybody feel like they belong.
Has it worked?
I think it has worked to some degree. to some degree. We've made a lot of changes. And then, I mean, after George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter movement, there was also the We See You White American Theater document, which was put together by a huge coalition of BIPOC theater makers around the country that set out a list of guidelines for what theaters can do to truly make their BIPOC artists and staff members feel welcome. And we did as much of that as we were able to do at Aurora. And we still think about that. We still look at that. We still look at the series of commitments that we made in response to that. And it's something that's really central to what I think Aurora needs to do to move forward, because the subscriptions are not going to come back in the same way. Younger people are less likely to subscribe than older folks. And I love the older folks. I love Aurora's audience so much. They're so smart and they're very loyal and they have such interesting takes on the world. They're so educated. They really engage with the plays on a truly intellectual level, which is fantastic. And there are plenty of young people and BIPOC people who are also interested in engaging with ideas, engaging with culture, engaging with ideas about science, engaging with community, who know what's going on in the world, who are interested in having the big conversations. And Aurora is a place where we have those big conversations and we tell stories that speak to what's going on in our community, in the world, in the present moment. And I think that is an appeal that cuts across a lot of different demographics, especially here in Berkeley, as you said, where we are a very engaged part of the world, where people who want to have those conversations.
Piano Fight went under, and that was a company or a place, a venue that appealed to younger people. But I also look at Shotgun, which is bringing them in, and I look over in the city at Ray of Light. So they're there, but how does a company that is known for having an older audience change without changing?
It's an interesting question, right? And again, I think it comes down to the kinds of stories that we tell, right? It's all about, you know, what are you going to experience when you come, right? So on one level, there's what we were talking about before of how do you make people feel welcome when they walk into our lobby, when they're greeted by our ushers, when they interact with our box office staff, when they interact with other patrons as well, because there sometimes can be issues there. But then it's about what stories are you telling and are these stories that feel relevant to people? You know, Shotgun Players, I admire them so much. They have such a distinct brand and style of theater. They do very experimental work and it's fantastic. You know, Piano Fight, I have such admiration for what they did. It reminded me so much of what I tried to do when I was running Impact Theater back in the 90s in the basement of the pizza parlor at Laval's. And Faultline Theater, which did their plays at Piano Fight, I'm on the board of Faultline Theater, and I admired what they did so much, and that was very much speaking directly to people in their generation, people in their 20s. And Aurora has a broader mission than that. We want to speak to people in their 20s. We want to speak to people in their 70s. We want to really be the place where the whole community can come together and have the hard conversations, have the important conversations, and share in exhilarating experiences together, because that is something that theater can offer that I think is truly unique, where you're in the same room with members of your community. And at Aurora, the people on the stage, the people who put the play together, are also members of the same community. And so the circle is complete. And when we do plays like, I mean, I'm going to bring up Eureka Day because I want to talk about that going to Broadway, but that was a play that we commissioned and developed, written by, directed by, starring with designers who are all parents in Berkeley. And it was a play about an elementary school in Berkeley. And the audience responded to that play very strongly because they recognize themselves on the stage. They recognize the story. And that story, even though it's so specific to Berkeley, has a universal appeal and has gone on to great success in other cities as well.
We'll come back in a second to some of the financial issues before we talk about the upcoming season. So Eureka Day, when I saw it, it absolutely blew my mind. There's a point where people are talking and what they're saying is funny. And at the same time, we're seeing what they're typing and what people listening to this Zoom thing are typing at the same time. And it's almost like you have to see it twice to catch all the jokes. And then it went off Broadway. Now it's going to Broadway?
It is. Yeah, it's opening on Broadway in December with a cast that includes Bill Irwin and Jessica Hecht, directed by Anna Shapiro. It's going to be a fantastic production. It was in London with a production with Helen Hunt and Mark McKinney. Like, it's just gone on to this great success and has really launched Jonathan Spector's career, and he deserves it. It is a brilliant piece of work. That particular scene, you know, the characters are holding a Facebook Live session for their school to talk about whether they need to institute a vaccination policy. And the conversation goes completely off the rails. And we're seeing both the parents who are on the school board on stage having this conversation, and we're seeing the comments that people are making on the Facebook Live session being projected above them. Teddy Hulsker did a fantastic job with that. The first preview, Jonathan and I were sitting there watching it, and the audience was just roaring with laughter to the point we couldn't hear any of the dialogue for like 5 straight minutes, which is unprecedented. We had to make it less funny so that a couple of key lines of dialogue you could hear. It was very strange for the actors to be like, I can't hear myself. I can't hear the other actors. It's just roaring laughter. Is that okay? And we said, yeah, you know what? These lines of dialogue, it's okay if people are laughing over them. We do want to pause just the right amount of time so that this one comes through, so we land that plot point. But it was incredible. And it's such a powerful play. I mean, it ends the first act with that uproarious scene and then comes back with some very serious talk about the consequences of children being unvaccinated.
Which, of course, with COVID afterwards, suddenly took on a new life of its own. Are you doing this direct? You're not directing it on Broadway.
I'm not directing it. No. Aurora's not involved. But we're very proud to have launched this play into the world. And we are doing on September 23rd, which is a Monday night, we are holding a fundraising event where we'll be doing a staged reading of the new Broadway draft of the script starring the original Aurora Theater Company cast. So if you missed it, if you want to see it again, you can come join us. It's going to be at Berkeley Rep's Rota Theater, which is 2 doors down from Aurora Theater Company. Jonathan Spector will be there. You'll be able to see it. We have Teddy Hulsker, our video designer, coming back. We will be projecting the Facebook comments as well. So it's a great opportunity to experience this play again in celebration of it moving to Broadway.
Is it very close to what we saw?
It's very close. There's been various tweaks that have happened at the various productions that Jonathan's been a part of along the way.
Let's go on quickly to the problems, financial problems. What
sure.
happened, and City of Berkeley came through,
yes.
and how is Aurora going forward?
So the deep background on that is that going into the pandemic, we had a pretty big chunk of savings, a reasonable chunk of savings for a theater our size. And so in that first year of producing again, we didn't know what ticket sales were going to be like. We didn't know what subscriptions were going to be like. But we knew that if we didn't produce a fantastic season of theater, we would never be able to get people to come back. And so we committed to a budget that had a pretty large deficit in it. And we had the savings to cover it. We eventually got the Shuttered Venues Operating Grant, which was $1 million or a little over $1 million for us. And that gave us this cushion to be able to have a budget that had a built-in deficit. Because that's just where we were at. And then each year since then, we thought, okay, that was really hard. We think we're seeing audiences starting to come back. This year, they're probably going to come back, but let's have another deficit budget this year. And hopefully it won't actually be as bad as we're budgeting because the audiences will come back. And we've been doing that for, 3 years, and the audiences haven't come back, and we can't keep doing it because the windfalls that we've received, including a big bequest at one point, the savings that we had pre-pandemic have all been spent down. So we are no longer able to have a deficit budget. In the spring, we did an emergency fundraising campaign to save Aurora, and we got so much support from this community, both financial contributions that people have made, but also the letters that they sent me and the emails that they sent me and things people said to me in the lobby. This company is so loved in this community, and it moved me very deeply to receive all of that support. We raised $200,000 from our major donors. We raised $250,000 from a public fundraising campaign, and 1,800 people signed a petition to the city of Berkeley asking for them to include emergency funding for Aurora. And Sophie Hahn introduced a measure at a city council meeting. I went to a lot of city council meetings, and Mayor Jesse put it into the budget and the board approved it. And so we're receiving $150,000 directly from the city, and we're so grateful.
But that's, again, a one shot.
Right. So it's a one shot. Exactly. So what that did was it allowed us to finish out the 23-24 season, and it allowed us to put a budget together that gets us through 24-25 without a massive deficit. But it wasn't enough to continue as we had been. And we knew we needed to not have another deficit budget. And so very unfortunately, we ended up having to lay off several members of our staff, and they were great people. They did great work for Aurora for years and years, and we're very, very sad to have lost them. And when we put the budget together, we realized that it would save us a significant amount of money to hire contractors, hire an outside firm to cover some of the work that had been doing by staff members. And we're still figuring out exactly how that's going to work and what our staff configuration is going to be going forward. As part of that, I'm taking a pretty significant pay cut, as is Robin Dolan, our managing director. And I'm no longer going to be directing in this season because I need to be spending more time on the admin side of things, making sure everything is running smoothly.
And does that mean smaller casts for the shows looking?
I mean, it's been that for a while. We had already set the season and we didn't change the season as a result of this. So we have four fantastic plays. The casts are not particularly large, but they're four plays that I think are really going to get people excited and have an impact.
And there's only four.
There's only four this year. Yeah, we had already made the decision to go from five to four. We are also, though, doing a special event, a cabaret performance, which we used to do every December, and we're doing it again. And this time it's very exciting. The Bay Area theater hip hop troupe, Felonious, is getting back together. They've been around for 20 years, and they are creating an original hip hop musical that we have commissioned. That's a departure for Aurora as well. But I've known these guys for a while. They're so talented and such good people. And they've been workshopping this musical. And so in December, we'll be presenting several performances of music from this piece that they are developing. And so that's an add-on to our season as well.
The previous season and before, there was one show I really didn't like. And this is going to go on the podcast, so I'm not concerned
about it. That's fine.
It was the one about Berkeley that went back and forward in time.
Yeah, The Incrementalist by Cleavon Smith.
And the problem with that is, even though I lived here, I didn't know the circumstances, and I walked in cold, and I walked out not knowing what I was watching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so here's the thing. I stand by the plays that we've done. I think that not every play is going to appeal to every person, and that's part of what happens when you expand your vision for what theater can be. And I think part of the nice thing about having a full season is that when you subscribe, you know there's going to be, you know, two or three plays that you really love. There might be one that is not for you. And sometimes that's really exciting and interesting to see a play that's really getting other types of people excited. And sometimes it can be frustrating because it feels like, oh, this one really isn't for me. But that's what I think it means to do a season that appeals to a broad part of the community, is that you're telling a diverse set of stories, and storytelling styles differ between cultures, right? And the things that different people are interested in are different. You know, obviously you want everybody to love every play, but I don't lose sleep over, you know, you having one play in the last few years that didn't do it for you.
On the other hand, this last season was great, so there you go.
I'll take it.
A couple of questions about this last season. What was the impetus behind doing 1984?
I feel like that is a story that is so timely right now. And you could say that at a lot of different points in history, that this is a timely story. But given especially what we know now about Project 2025, given some of the things that are happening around the country and around the world, this drift towards authoritarianism, this appeal that authoritarianism has for so many people, it felt like a really important time to tell a story that directly addresses that. And 1984 it's one of my favorite books. I've read it so many times and I love it. And Michael Gene Sullivan wrote such a brilliant adaptation of it. He came up with a way to tell that story on stage that really works as a piece of theater. It's not just okay, let's try to get every scene and figure out how we can stage it. It has a framing device of this interrogation of Winston, and the interrogators and Winston together are retelling certain moments from his story as a way to get him to admit his guilt, and ultimately as a way to control him. That gives the play such immediacy and such power. And the cast that we put together, the incredible work that Barbara Damaschek did directing that play, I was so proud to be able to tell that story. And people really responded to it. People said, oh my gosh, this feels so right now.
Did that have a slightly higher audience level?
It did well. I mean, when you do a play that's based on a famous book, you know, we did The Year of Magical Thinking before the pandemic, right? When you do a play that people are familiar with, yeah, you're going to get some people who come out because of the title.
Well, that brings up one final question before we get to the new season. When I spoke with Bill English, maybe I was not quite up on the economics at that moment.
Sure.
I kept asking, why guys and dolls? Why this? Why that? You know, and why are we only seeing maybe one or two plays that I'm looking forward to and finding interesting? And his response, of course, was, we got to bring in the audience. They know the play.
Yeah.
For you, Josh Costello, after 1984 and looking at this season and upcoming seasons, what's your perspective? I mean, I don't see any famous musicals here.
No, Aurora doesn't do famous musicals. We are, you know, we are experimenting with using music. We've commissioned this hip-hop musical from these guys, Thelonious, and they are writing a story that's very much grounded in our community, right? And so that is much more interesting to me if we're going to do something with music than doing, you know, an old, you know, musical that everybody else has done as well, which is not to blame Bill English and SF Playhouse, right? I mean, the only plays that have been selling consistently well since the pandemic, since the reopening, are musicals and plays that have movie stars in them. It's been very hard to sell out a show that doesn't have those things. And that's just not Aurora's style. We don't, you know, we had, you know, Elijah Alexander, who's a television star, but he's also a theater actor who's worked at Aurora before. And we try to tell stories, again, that speak to our community in the present moment. And I still believe that in the long run, that's what makes a great theater. And that's what is going to make Aurora, you know, have another 30 years of being a beloved institution in the Bay Area.
Let's talk about this upcoming season. The first show, Fallen Angels, it's by Noel Coward. It's a show that in the 1920s was censored. Yes. And continued to be censored because of adultery in particular. What brought you to that, and how do you see that particular play fitting into what you've been talking about with Aurora?
First of all, Noel Coward is brilliant. He's so witty. He's so funny. You know, I directed Importance of Being Earnest by Oscar Wilde at Aurora a few years ago, and I really see Noel Coward as continuing in the tradition of Oscar Wilde. And he actually wrote about being gay in some of his later plays, and he lived a lifestyle that did not conform to the expectations of the time. And he wrote about women, and also men sometimes, but in this play, two women in particular who make their own choices, right? Who don't follow what's expected of them. And I found that really inspiring and really exciting, especially in a play from the 1920s. It's not quite as revolutionary as it was then that women might actually have sex with somebody different than their husband before they got married, or might still be attracted to somebody after they've been married. But it's a delightful, hilarious play that also really deals with female agency. And I thought that was really exciting. But here's the thing. I mean, I think that's a fair question to ask. Okay, well, if you're talking about relevant in the present moment and then you're doing a Noel Coward, how does that fit together? And I really learned from Importance of Being Earnest, which is a play that I just deeply love as a play. The experience that that play created for our audience was tremendously relevant because it was a chance for our audience to come together and share in laughter, in a lot of laughter. And, you know, it's a play that, you know, similarly to Fallen Angels, flips the script in a lot of different ways. It inverts the normal social expectations. And that subversiveness is really exciting to me and feels really, really modern and relevant as well. I also very carefully programmed this play in November, right after the election, which I think hopefully will be a time of extreme joy and maybe a time when we really need something to enjoy and have some good laughs. And I think no matter what happens, I think we'll be happy to have a chance to come together and share in some subversion and laughter.
Is this a multiracial cast?
It is.
Is it set in the 1920s?
Yes, it is.
So are we at a point as an audience that can take the fact that this play is dealing with racial issues that would not exist in 1920s?
Well, there were people who weren't white in London in the 1920s. And so I think the way I look at it is that whenever you're telling a story, the default assumption doesn't need to be that the characters are all white, even if, you know, that's how it was done when it was first produced. We have people at all levels of society doing all kinds of different things with their lives that are all different races. And our theater should reflect that.
The reason I ask that, when these kinds of casting changes happened, there were questions from audiences scratching their heads. And now I think we may be at a point where they're not anymore.
I hope so. I hope so. I think this has been a long time coming. You know, we went through the colorblind casting phase, which had its own set of problems, and now we're more in the color conscious casting phase. You know, one of the things that I think about a lot that I learned at one point in my journey is that people of color have grown up being exposed to mainstream American media where most of the stories are about white people. And they have developed, as a result, the skill to be able to see the universal in a story about somebody who doesn't look like them. White folks in America, many of us grew up seeing white folks in the media and never developed that skill. And so some people, some white folks, their initial reaction to seeing a story that does not have white people in it or that centers BIPOC folks, they have a harder time at first seeing this as something that is potentially speaking to them, seeing it as something that is speaking to universal themes. And they have this instinct to see it as something that is only for people who match the race of the actors on the stage. We've been doing color conscious casting at Aurora for a long, long time, and I think our audience has come along on this. I think it's exciting to be able to tell the story the way we're doing it.
Is that play in the public domain?
So it's interesting. There is a version of it that is in the public domain, and then there is a revision that Noel Coward did in the 1950s, which is much funnier, that is not in the public domain. So we are paying royalties to the estate. And this is actually Noel Coward's 125th birthday year. And so there's a lot going on with Noel Coward around the country and around the world. ACT is doing Private Lives right before we do Fallen Angels. So if you're a Coward fan, you get a real extravaganza of Coward this fall.
If you were using the other version, would you have thought of, say, making the man a woman?
Anything's on the table. I think, you know, I'm not directing this one. I was going to direct it. Now Tom Ross has stepped in, and I'm so excited, and he's done such a great job so far putting the cast and team together and coming up with the, you know, working on the set design and everything. So I think anything's on the table, and I think it comes down to what is the vision for this production. And I think you can tell a story in a lot of different ways. And, you know, Aurora tends to tell stories in a fairly traditional way. We tell stories that have a beginning, a middle, and an end most of the time. We tell stories that mainly happen between the characters, that the interaction between the characters, that visceral connection between the characters is where the meaning and where the plot lives. And so we tend to do more naturalistic plays. And there are plenty of theaters out there that do other things as well. You know, again, I think it comes down to, you know, you pick the play, right? You know basically what the story is going to be. You bring in a director. You talk about the vision. The director brings a vision to it. And hopefully the director brings a vision to it that is unique, that is rooted in the text, that is understanding of the world as it exists now, and that tells a story that is compelling.
Had that play been in your mind for some time? Or
I've been thinking about doing a Coward, and I was looking at different Cowards. I was looking at Private Lives before I realized ACT was doing it. And Fallen Angels has been, I feel like I had read it. I may have read it, may have not read it, may have just heard about it. But when I reread it in consideration for this, it just felt like such an obvious choice. I think it's just as good, just as funny as the better known titles, The Blithe Spirits and The Private Lives and Hay Fevers.
Yeah, when I was looking it up earlier today, I noticed there's never been a movie of it.
Interesting.
Yeah, there have been a couple of productions, BBC things, but yeah, of all the Noel Cowards, that one has never actually been filmed, which is kind of weird.
I wonder if that might be because the leads are two women.
Could be. Moving on to the next play, The Heart Sellers by Lloyd Tse, and that is a co-production with, what is it, Capitol Stage in Sacramento. And then it's going to be at Theater Works sometime in the spring.
That's right.
So it's right after your production.
That's
right. It will be at Theater Works. And I guess this came as a result of conversations with Giovanna and the artistic director over in Sacramento.
Yeah,
and
Michael Stevenson.
What happened?
Yeah, so this play, you know, it had its world premiere not too long ago in Milwaukee, and it's been making the rounds. And Lloyd is a, you know, amazing American playwright. Berkeley Rep just did one of his productions with the same director as this, actually. And so we were all reading the play around the same time, and we all fell in love with it. It is a beautiful story. It's about two women, again, who are immigrants to the United States in the 1970s under the Hart-Sellers Act. Their husbands are doctors or studying to be doctors, and they find themselves sort of alone in a new country where they don't know anyone, and they don't really, you know, aren't as familiar with the culture. They're missing their homes and their families, but they're also excited about making a life for themselves, and they find each other. They're from two different cultures. One of them is from the Philippines. One is from Korea. And they strike up this friendship and decide they're going to cook Thanksgiving dinner together, having never experienced a Thanksgiving dinner. And they drink a lot of wine, and you get to know these two people as they get to know each other. And it's a play about the American experience, the immigrant experience. It's a play that just has a tremendous amount of heart in it. And I think Michael and Gio and I all read it and really felt strongly that this is a story that needs to be told. And of course, TheaterWorks is a much larger theater, and Gio has a relationship with Lloyd. I had known Michael since he acted in the first play I directed at Aurora 12 years ago, Wittenberg. And I was getting to know Gio as well. And we have very similar tastes. And, you know, we all started talking about who's going to do this play and realized that it might be very exciting for us to do it all together. And, you know, we started working out the details. We're still working out the details. But I think it's a very exciting thing to have a play that is going to be a fabulous production, and it's going to happen at three different theaters.
And I guess financially, it means that the cost is... I'm getting weird looks from you.
Yeah, it doesn't save as much money as you'd think.
Really?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You have a very unique stage
exactly.
to work with.
Yeah.
Very different from TheaterWorks, that's for sure.
It's very different from TheaterWorks. A capital stage is also a thrust, but they're a very wide, shallow thrust, whereas we are a very narrow, deep thrust. And so we're having to do some work to figure out how the set is going to change to be in our space after it's in their space.
But it's same actors, same director.
Yeah.
For them to rehearse, it's the same play.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just the productions are very different.
Yeah. Yeah. The staging is going to be very different.
Crumbs from the Table of Joy is Lynn Nottage's very first play. What prompted you to decide on that particular play?
Well, again, you know, I read it and fell in love with it. I think it's a beautiful play. It deserves to be part of the American canon. It's a play that tells the story of a black family moving to the North, as so many did, and settling in Brooklyn and being in a very different world. The main character is the teenage daughter. She is adjusting to a very different life. Her father is very religious. The mother is not in the picture. And the father's sister has already been in New York and Harlem and is a very different kind of person than her brother, the father. The father is very religious, very strict, very constrained. And his sister, the aunt, is a very political, hard drinking, partying kind of person who is really living a very full and interesting life. And that presents the teenage daughter. There's two teenage daughters, but the one who's the main character with, you know, an opportunity to rethink what her life can be.
And that's 1950s.
It's 1950s Brooklyn.
Brooklyn moving from
Pensacola.
The south.
Yeah.
Yeah. How did you find that one?
I mean, Lynn Nottage is one of the great American playwrights. And so I've been looking at different ones of her plays, and a lot of them have been done in the area already. And this one has been done, but not at a major theater recently. And so it seemed like a great choice. I'm very excited to have Elizabeth Carter coming in to direct. Elizabeth directed Stoop Stories for us, which we mentioned earlier, and has acted in several plays that I've directed. And she's just a fantastic Bay Area theater maker.
And the final play, I assume you're not getting Lily Tomlin.
No.
The Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe by Jane Wagner. And, of course, it was written for Lily Tomlin and filmed with Lily Tomlin. What brought you to decide to just deal with it as a one-person play with a different actress doing something obviously completely different?
Yeah. You know, I saw that, you know, video of Lily Tomlin doing it and when I was younger and loved it and loved Lily and thought it was so funny and smart. You know, it's been done several times by other people. It was on Broadway not too long ago. And so it seemed like it was sort of fair game for a production. Clearly, of course, it being a solo show is something that we're, you know, looking for. You know, we had a really successful solo show a few years ago with The Year of Magical Thinking. And so we know that they work well in our space. And this play, it's so funny. It's such an opportunity for virtuosic acting. We do not have a cast to announce at this point. Jennifer King is going to come and direct it. She's done some really wonderful plays for us. And we're talking about casting it now. But I think it's going to be really exciting. We're also starting a community partnership with the Dorothy Day House, which is a homeless shelter that does amazing work right around the corner from Aurora in the Veterans Building. Because, you know, the central character of this play is what is described in the play as a bag lady. And there's a stereotype at work there. And so I reached out. We had already had some contact with the Dorothy Day House when there was food being prepared on stage in one of our productions. And so at the end of the night, we had all this food and we ended up donating it to the homeless shelter. And I had visited and done a tour of their space and met their director. And so we're still working out the details. You know, we really want to make sure that it's a respectful and authentic production. And I think it's going to be delightful.
When you're looking at plays, how long does it take? Are they kind of in a back drawer and you pull it out and go, oh, wait, we could do this one? Or in your mind, is that what's going on?
I have a spreadsheet. I have lists. I have so many plays in my inbox to read. I will never be able to get to all of them. The list only ever gets longer. But, you know, as much as I can, I'm reading plays and making notes, thinking about how to slot plays into a season. There's always more plays that I want to do than we have room for. And so it's about how do they all fit together and to make a cohesive season. There are plays that, you know, maybe I wanted to do a year or two ago that didn't make it into the season that I'm still considering for the following season. And there's plays that come across my desk. There's, you know, there's the plays that we commission as well. Not only Filonis, we also have Barbara Damashek under commission writing a piece for us, which I'm excited about, through our Originate and Generate play development program. So there's a lot of different ways that plays come into the conversation. Sometimes directors will pitch plays, and I love that because I know that the director is passionate about the work. Sometimes, you know, actors will suggest plays. Sometimes, you know, we get a lot of plays sent to us by playwrights' agents and by playwrights. And we're reading reviews and requesting scripts from different theaters. And so it's a very robust process for trying to make sure that we put together the best season we can.
Josh Costello, if you had all the money in the world and could put on any play with any size cast, what's the one that comes most to your mind?
You know, honestly, it's commissioning a new play. It's working with a playwright.
Really?
You know, I think, you know, there's a lot of great plays from the past. I haven't directed a Shakespeare in a long time. I really miss that. I used to love directing Shakespeare plays, and it hasn't happened. So I could say, yeah, I'd love to direct Hamlet or King Lear, right? Romeo and Juliet. But, and there, you know, there's so many, I mean, there's so many plays to choose from, right? But really what gets me the most excited is working on a story that is in the process of being written and that has something really specific to say that I really believe in. So Eureka Day is a great example of that. But also, you know, this past year, you know, Born with Teeth was not a world premiere, but it was the second production. The playwright was with us all the way through. And it was just really rewarding to have that collaboration with a playwright as well as with the actors and the designers. And again, to be thinking about how is this play in conversation with the community.
And on that particular play, Born with Teeth, a friend of mine from L.A. was heading up and visiting relatives in Oregon, gave me a list of plays. I saw that one in Aurora. That's the one you should see. Yeah. And the word afterward was, thank you so much.
It's a great play. Liz Duffy Adams is just such a brilliant playwright and a brilliant human and a lovely person. And, you know, she wrote a play that gets at very pressing issues today through a story that is set in the past and does it with such panache and such fun and such grittiness. It's just a lovely piece of writing.
It's a two-person play between Marlowe and Shakespeare that goes in a lot of different directions. And God, tracking that one down was hit a winner there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I had been, you know, Liz and I had been talking for years about me directing something of hers. I really respond to her writing. And, you know, when that one came across my desk, I just fell in love with it immediately. I mean, I'm saying that a lot, but that's what happens. That's why I program plays, because I fall in love with them. It just was right up my alley. All the Shakespeare and Marlowe stuff is so fascinating. And all, you know, everything in the play could have really happened. And so it's great. Yeah. And she's wonderful.
Josh Costello, here we are about to start this next season. You have to be thinking past this season, well into next. You're going to get back into directing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. We have a lot to figure out right now with this new configuration of our staff. And we're going to figure it all out. It's going to take a little time. And we don't know what our financial situation is going to be like a year from now. I mean, it is not like we're in great shape. I will say this, we're here. We still depend on the generosity of this community. We are doing this event around Eureka Day, which is a fundraising event that needs to go well. We'll be doing our fall campaign. We need to sell a lot of tickets. We need to sell a lot of subscriptions. But my sincere hope and belief is that a year from now, we'll be in a better position than we are right now. We'll have our systems in place and figured out. Maybe we'll be able to grow our staff back to some degree. And I'll be in a position where I'm able to, you know, step away to some degree for a few weeks and direct a play.
You've been listening to an interview with Josh Costello, who is the artistic director of Aurora Theater in Berkeley, up the block from Berkeley Rep, right there in downtown Berkeley. And for more information, you can go to auroratheater.org.
Until next time, I'm Rich Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays. You can write to me either at bookwaves@hotmail.com or richard@kpfa.org. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky Radio Shows on Facebook.